8 p.m. at the Jade Club, 315 Southeast 3rd Avenue in Portland. More information on the event can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, the transportation choice of Portlanders since 1946, with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab has a mobile app that allows you to book a cab with your phone, available at the App Store, Google Play, and at radiocab.net. Or, if you prefer, you can talk to a real person at 503-227-1212.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Waiting for, and my time was running wild, a million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I'd got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet, so I turned myself to face me.
All right, we are live.
Hey, good evening. This is the Trans Positive Radio Show, and we're live now on KBOO.
Welcome. We are here tonight with our co-hosts. We're just throwing things together. Just like community radio should.
Racing into the studio.
So great. Let's do introductions. Let's start with you, Jean.
Okay. I'm Jean Bryant. I use she and her pronouns.
My name's Emma Lugo. I use she and her pronouns.
My name's Nicolette Schweizer. I use A&M pronouns.
I'm Carrie Cantrell. I can use non-binary pronouns.
Okay. We've got a great show this evening for you. We've got a couple of recorded interviews. A lot has happened since our last show over the course of this last month, so we have a lot of topics to cover. Most of the show will be a pre-recorded interview that we did regarding the United States Trans Survey, which happened over the course of the summer of 2015. It's been rolled out, and we got a great show on that. We also have an interview with someone down in North Carolina.
Janice Covington.
Yeah, about the HB2 and its failure. We have a couple other topics that we're going to get into.
We're also going to talk about the Portland Trans Town Hall.
Yes.
Coming up. Yeah. So let's see if we're ready in the studio. Okay, great. Yeah. It looks like we are. So we're going to cue straight to Mara Kiesling with the U.S. Trans Survey.
Yeah. Okay. This is the Trans Positive PDX radio show on KBOO here in Portland, Oregon. And I am Jean Bryant. And with us on the phone today, we have Mara Kiesling from the National Center for Transgender Equality. They are the sponsoring organization that conducted the United States Transgender Survey in 2015. And they just rolled out the report. With us in the studio are several of our co-hosts, and I'll just let them introduce themselves.
Yeah, hey, my name is Nico Serra. Use they and he for pronouns. I'm involved with politics and do activist work and organizing. And yeah, just glad to be here on the show. Thank you.
And I'm Nicolette Schweizer. I'm a co-host here at KBOO, and I prefer A&M pronouns.
Hi, my name is Carrie Cantrell. I'm the director of Northwest Intersex Action League. I'm agender, so you can use whatever pronouns you need to.
My name is Emma Lugo, and I'm one of the co-producers of Transpositive here on KBOO.
Our guest on the telephone is Mara Kiesling. Mara, would you introduce yourself, please?
I'm so glad to be on the call, Jean and everybody. I'm Mara. I'm the executive director of the National Center for Transgender Equality here in Washington, D.C., and I use she pronouns.
Mara, the survey that has been rolled out, you rolled it out about 3 weeks ago on December 8th here, 2016. I observed that it took well over a year of work to analyze the data and compile the report. That's a lot of time and effort by a lot of organizations and professional individuals to really put this thing together. And I want to compliment you on an absolutely incredible piece of work. It's clearly the best methodology and the best most defensible, usable, comprehensive data set ever produced.
Thank you. Yeah, it is a huge data set. You know, we have just under 28,000 participants. Yeah, we're a very, very diverse group.
Indeed. Well, I would like to open this up to the panel here to go ahead and start posing some questions and observations to you, Mara. So we're going to go over here to Nicolette first.
All right. Hi, Mara.
Hey.
What do you think the results of this survey say about the inclusion of non-binary people in the trans community?
It means we understand better who we are. And it means that a lot of the work that a lot of folks have been doing to not just to include people in a community way, but also to, you know, NCTE is, you know, largely a policy organization. And it speaks to very much to how groups like ours need to do policy, something we've been on top of for a surprisingly high number of years already at NCTE. But hopefully other folks will learn from that and understand that we still have a lot of work to do in terms of how we advocate, who we involve and include, and what language we use.
All right. Thank you, Mara.
Well, I was just thinking while you were talking about that, about, you know, how right now talking about policy and thinking about policy and what we're going to need to do collectively as we move forward in the political atmosphere that we've been, you know, we're being exposed to. Is, you know, folks who are non-binary, who are gender non-conforming, people who are visibly different, and this goes, you know, for outside of our communities as well, people who are visibly different are the most vulnerable right now. And I think that that's probably always been true, you know, somebody with dark skin, somebody that's wearing, a headscarf, you know, somebody that doesn't look, you know, as I always say, like a Ken or a Barbie doll, like, you know, people who are in between, how we're going to be able to create, help each other find safety and safe spaces wherever we are, because we are everywhere. And I think that's something that, you know, we see from this survey is that we're all over the place and we're vulnerable. So that was just something that really stood out to me.
Yeah. What it means for, you know, non-binary folks and folks who don't fit in and folks who are visibly queer, you know, I don't know. You know, if it gets really, really bad, you know, I who knows how it'll shake up? Who knows whether people will start heading for the closet? And you know, I don't think I'd venture to say who's going to be most successful at hiding in the closet. I mean, it certainly doesn't feel like a winning strategy, but for some individuals it may seem that way, and they may want to try to do that.
Yes, Emma.
What are some of the main points in the trans survey? What are some of the things that really stood out to you?
Yeah. So I would prefer to be general here. I will probably mention some specific numbers, but I think the general themes are more important and more interesting in a lot of ways. So some of the things we saw was the trans people are still very dramatically marginalized economically, in terms of, you know, unemployment rate, in terms of living below the poverty level. You know, it's funny, one of the numbers we saw that was so shocking was our home ownership rate. Well, I'm going to look through my papers here real quick, but the home ownership rate is so much lower among trans people than among the population as a whole. I think among the population as a whole, it's about 62% of the people of people own their homes.
And I think we're about 16%.
Say that again?
Yeah, I think we're about 16%, Mara.
Yeah, so we were dramatically under. But then when you look at the whole picture, it almost seems ridiculous talking about home ownership when you're talking about trans people, because it is so far removed from most trans people's reality. That it seems like in the hierarchy of needs, getting housing is so much more important still for so many trans people than is owning an actual home.
Actually owning
a home. You know, so we saw the economic marginalization. One thing we saw, again, that we saw certainly in the last survey, and is not going to be surprising to anybody, but when you add racism on top of transphobia, the impact is just multiplied. So a trans person of color, you know, who has to face both transphobia and racism is just going to be significantly more hurt and marginalized than white trans people. We did see lots generally to feel positive about in some sort of sick ways. You know, it depends how you look at the numbers. So for instance, 25% of our sample said, 23% of the sample said they skipped going to a doctor last year because they were afraid they would be disrespected or treated badly because they were trans. Now that's a horrifically high number, and we have to work to fix that. You know, but there are some people who would look at it the other way and say, oh my gosh, 77% of us now feel more comfortable going to doctors.
Yes.
And, you know, that, you know, it's more of a glass half full kind of look, but it's still, you know, a quarter of us, you know, don't trust our healthcare providers. You know, a really interesting thing about that same number, that 23% of folks who skipped going to a doctor in the last year, skipped getting medical attention because they were afraid they'd be disrespected. It was actually 33% of the sample who skipped getting medical care because they couldn't afford it. So for trans people, in this one specific way, poverty is a bigger obstacle to health care than disrespect. I'm not saying that's a good thing at all. I switched the subject from that. It's a really stark reminder that trans people aren't just facing transphobia. They are in many cases facing racism and poverty and ableism and ageism and all the other scourges in our society. That if we want to really be a moral and effective trans movement, we have to take into account better.
So the results of the survey showed that 39% of respondents experienced severe psychological distress in the past month. 40% have attempted suicide at some point in their lives. And 33% have had a negative experience with a healthcare provider due to their gender identity. Those are very startling numbers.
What I learned from the 39%, so just a short version of how that we got that. There's a test that's often given called the Kessler Psychological Distress Scale, or the Kessler 6 scale, the number 6. And basically what it is you're asked a series of questions like, in the last 30 days, have you felt depression? Have you felt anxiety? Have you felt loneliness? Et cetera. And then when you have, it says, how much of an impact did that have on your ability to do errands, to take care of yourself, to take care of your family, to go to work, et cetera. And in general, 6% of the country at any given time, 6% of adults are thought to be in severe psychological distress under the CSR-6 scale. That's the general population. The trans population is eight times higher. And it means, and where I would start with is how we treat each other, because that's something all of us have control over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, Mara, I'm observing in terms of the methodology that the survey does not sample folks below 18 years of age. And so, you know, that skews some of the picture from a number of different perspectives. And I wonder if you might comment on some of those. One of the things that I observed immediately is that the chapter 8 on experiences at school would not necessarily then reflect current circumstances. Can you comment on some of that?
We made a decision early on that trans adults were different than trans kids. This is particularly true right now when we really have our first generation of trans kids coming up. You know, when I graduated from high school in 1977, there was not an out trans student in public high school in all of America. This is a new thing, and trans kids are a different phenomenon, cultural phenomenon, and demographic phenomenon. And we made a couple decisions. I mean, we made the decision to exclude minors because of that, because we thought they would benefit from a specific survey of them.
Oh, good, good.
Which we're talking about doing, and we're talking about also doing a survey of parents of trans youth.
Excellent.
Mm, great.
So it's one of the biggest questions we've gotten, particularly from parents of trans youth, mm-hmm. who I don't think the trans youth themselves are particularly caring, but I'm sure the older trans youth are, but a lot of parents of trans kids have, and it's a really good question. And these are folks who really should be surveyed, and we're trying to figure out how to do that.
Yeah.
So speaking of information gathering tactics and like where, how, and who you speak to, I'd like you to speak to the importance of a community-driven conversation, and if it's important to you over at NCTGE and why, and how you plan to use that angle of as far as trans community talking to trans community.
Sure. It's something we thought a lot about. We went as far as we thought we could in that direction. At the same time, what we were trying to do was, what we were primarily trying to do here, honestly, was to create advocacy tools. We as a primarily advocacy organization, you know, before the NTDS in 2011, the National Transformation Survey, we used to go visit members of Congress and say, oh, unemployment's really bad. Mm. And they'd say, how bad? And we'd say, it's bad. And the unemployment rate's really high. And they'd say, how high? And we'd be like, oh, it's super high. And we couldn't do that. We needed to create real real data that we could stand by and it wasn't assailable. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, we did have to remember all the time that we were creating, we were doing science. We weren't doing community manifesto. So it was really challenging. There were a lot of times in the survey where we had to do some things that would seem politically challenging to many trans people. And I can't tell you how many different people yelled at us because of some wording we did. But it was all carefully thought out.
Are you referring, sorry to interrupt, are you referring to dialogue within the survey specifically, or are you talking about methods of reaching out to trans people for their information?
Well, I'm talking about the content of the questionnaire, which is not dialogue. And then the reach out to the community, there were a lot of challenges with that too. you know, because we made a decision that it had to be an online survey, that means right away there's going to be an online survey bias that all online surveys have. So we know that would hurt us with seniors. We know it would hurt us with people of color.
Right.
And we knew it would hurt us with Southerners. And in fact, our survey is not where we would want it to be in those demographic groups. But it for a lot of technical reasons, and in order to get as many people as we did, it had to be an online survey. What we were not trying to do, what this project just wasn't, was a dialogue with the community. It wasn't meant to be that. It's not what we needed it to be. And there's that. But what we did is we focused lots of, I mean, just that we got 28,000 people, I think shows that we did pretty decent outreach.
Yes.
You know, we were particularly, reaching out to the audiences that we knew were going to be hard for us to get. People of color, seniors, and Southerners. And in fact, you know, if you look at the geographic distribution of the survey by state, there are four states that did substantially better than their population would cause us to expect: Washington, Oregon, Massachusetts, and D.C. And these are places with really well-developed trans communities who are networked pretty well. In the South, we underrepresented in every state but Arkansas, and that's because the movement as a whole has traditionally ignored the South. And so the, whatever it was, 800 or 900 organizations that helped network this for us, they weren't as well networked in the South.
Got you.
And we weren't able to overcome that with our outreach, despite trying pretty hard. And, you know, the people of color outreach was really assertive and ultimately insufficient.
Interesting, yeah.
And, you know, we learned some things that we'll do better next time.
Awesome. Great. Should I go next?
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. So I wanted to get back to the economics issue that we were discussing earlier, because I found that was another kind of startling find in the survey, is that 29% of the respondents were living in poverty, 15% were unemployed, 30% had been homeless at some point in their lives, and 12% had been homeless in the past year.
Yeah, so what we will be using the survey for, so remember, this survey is meant as a community resource. It's meant, honestly, as a advocacy tool for NCTE and other policy advocacy organizations, but it also is meant for a research tool for the community. We've already been contacted by lots of researchers who want to look at a particular angle that we just will never have time or the mission to do. But you know, a lot of our federal policy work that led ultimately to well over 150, I shouldn't say well over, it was about 154, I was going to say well over 150, so, you know, just over 150 federal policy wins, most of which, by the way, are going to stay.
Yay.
I think trans people are nervous that they'll all go away instantly, but, you know, we're going to fight on every hill and, you know, try to keep as many of them as we can. This is evidence for them. So all of the great work we did with HUD, including the guidance that HUD put out late last year or early this year around rules for homeless shelters to take federal money to treat people according to their gender identity. That's a direct result from this. Section 1557 regulations in the Affordable Care Act, that's the non-discrimination section of the Affordable Care Act, when Health and Human Services issued their regulations, they cited this study. They cited our old study. So from a policy change point of view, this information's invaluable. Then what we would hope, and it's a little trickier now because people voted in people who don't like us, and that's just a fact. We would hope that you know, advocates in the state level, including policymakers, would look at the data, and they'd say, oh, well, here's something we can do to help fill these obvious gaps, and you know, homelessness is certainly one of them. And by the way, one of the things we will be doing in the next few weeks and months, as we can, honestly, because we're still a very small organization, but because we have these 28,000 participants in the survey, respondents, we can do state-specific numbers. So, and obviously, the example I should use is probably Oregon. We interviewed 1,168 Oregonian trans people, so almost 1,200 Oregonian trans people. So we will, in the near future, the next couple weeks and months, look for partner in Oregon, and I won't presuppose who it is. I just don't know. There's, you know, and so we're going to be putting out Oregon specific data with these 1,200, and they'll be, you know, whoever our partners are or is or are in Oregon, they'll no doubt do a press conference, and then, you know, everybody who does advocacy with the state legislature is going to, you know, send a report to the state legislature saying, oh my God, look at this, and we'll use this to advocate. The survey itself doesn't prescribe specific policy remedies, and that's honestly really hard for us because that's what we do as a whole, as an organization, but we wanted the survey to be more about what's going on, mm-hmm. and then just have the advocates, including advocates in our organization, but have us later use the data to say, here's what's going on, and now here's what we think should be done about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What I would like to do here is give you an opportunity to kind of close out. My observation that I very much appreciated, and I think is one of the most informative things about the data, is, and it's acknowledged in some of the conclusions in the report, and that is the compounding effect of other issues, okay? Racism, misogyny in general, there are a lot of compounding effects here. And when you look at some of the data set a little more in depth, you begin to see things jump out at you, you know, like the economics and stuff. Well, I'd like to hear you have an opportunity to kind of address that in the context of how that informs our activism and some of the coalition building that we need to do.
What it does for me as an activist, so not me as a research team member, not me as the executive director of NCTE, but me as an actual activist, it really helps me understand that any given trans person I'm talking to, or thinking about, or interacting with, or being attacked by, or being praised by, or working with, any one of them. So people, I get asked a lot by reporters, what's the biggest issue for trans people? And I always say, that's really easy. I know the correct answer. And they're like, oh, good, what's the correct answer? And I say, it depends on which trans person you ask.
Yeah.
Because that's the right question. There are trans people who the single most important issue is there's no trans-specific care available to them, either because of cost or something else. For some trans people, the most important issue might be racism. For some trans people, the most important issue might be violence, or it might be emotional distress, or it might be that their dog just died. What we do know is it's probably violence, discrimination, and access to health care. And it depends who you are. But what this also shows us, this compounding effect, is that we really can't be effective for trans people unless our movement is not just a pro-trans movement, but it has to be an anti-racism movement and a pro-immigrant movement, a pro-worker, pro-woman, pro-disability rights movement. Because that's who we are. And those identities matter to us. Those identities have not that those identities themselves only bring bad things, because they don't, but you know, we just have to keep in mind that to be trans activists, we have to be these other kinds of activists too.
True.
Yeah, I think that the solidarity, being able to show up for each other when, for example, like with Black Lives Matter, I wear a Black Lives Matter button every day. And last mm-hmm. week, a guy, when I was up at Salem trying to encourage the Electoral College to do something else, I met a guy in a wheelchair, and he said, "Oh, well, all lives matter." And I said, when Black Lives matter, all lives will matter.
Right. Yeah. Trans mm-hmm. rights are human rights. When
exactly.
human rights are honored, then trans rights will be honored.
Absolutely.
Do that. And Mara, with that, we're getting the axe from the control panel here.
Thank you so much.
Wow.
Thank you. Thank you, Mara. This was a great experience.
Oh, I'm so happy
Thank
to you. Talk to everybody, and look forward to being in Hungry. Portland again soon sometime.
Oh, thank
Come
you for
see
the work
us at
you
KBOO.
Do.
Definitely.
Always love to see you. Thank you again so, so much.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We're back.
Okay.
Hi, everybody. We're live.
Okay. Yeah. So, am I live?
Yep, yeah. You're live.
Okay, thank you. I couldn't hear that mic. The full text, it's 300 plus pages, folks, but the full text of the survey is available on the National Center for Transgender Equality's website. That's at www.transequality.org. Right on their homepage. It's very prominent there. It's easy to find.
www.transequality.org?
Yes.
All right, great. And also I wanted to add that the portion of the interview we just played was actually only about half of the full interview. So the entire interview will be posted on our podcast, hopefully sometime soon.
At transpositive.wordpress.com?
Yeah, I think so. I'll definitely post the link on our Facebook page once that's up. So if you like or follow our Facebook page, then you'll see that when the link is posted. That's at facebook.com/transpositivePDX.
Great. And we're going to go to a quick music break.
All right, we're back. And next we'll be playing an interview with Janice Covington Allison regarding the HB2 in South Carolina. Or is it North Carolina?
North Carolina.
North Carolina. All right.
Yeah.
So here's Janice.
We're talking with Janice Covington Allison. Janice is an activist from North Carolina. Janice, can you just tell us what recently happened in North Carolina with HBL 2?
Well, y'all, we didn't have a fun week. I don't know if you were following the special session that we were going to have HB 2 repealed, but it didn't go down the way that we would have liked it to. We didn't get it repealed, so it's still there.
Janice, has anyone actually been arrested in North Carolina yet for using the bathroom?
Not for using the bathroom, no. Not that I'm aware of.
But the threat is there.
The threat is always there. It's kind of difficult. You know, they have, HB 2 has provisions in it, you know, that says that a transgender person can't use a bathroom that aligns with their gender identity and only be able to use a bathroom that corresponds with their birth gender.
So it sounds like HB 2 in practice has really been more of an antagonistic approach to encourage some form of social policing of genders and binaries and social roles. Would you say that's accurate?
Well, that's what we kind of figured in the beginning, that it would be a social type thing. You know, people come along and you know, making calling the police or calling a store manager or you know, just causing a fuss, you know, and causing people, you know, especially younger transgender people, us older ones, we don't care. But the younger ones would get embarrassed. You know what I mean?
Sounds like state sanctioned terrorism to me. Actually, if we're being real, let's not mince words.
I was in the Charlotte Mecklenburg government building, going to a city council meeting about a year and a half ago, and I was to speak, and I was representing myself as the chair of diversity and outreach for the Democratic Party of the state. And also I had some of the caucuses, you know, that wanted me to speak for them. And when I went in, it was windy outside, and I went into the ladies' room to fix my hair, and I heard the door open a minute or two after I went in, and I turned and looked, and there was a policewoman. And I said, hello. And she said, well, you're going to have to leave. I said, what do you mean I'm going to have to leave? And she said, well, there's a bunch of people out here in the lobby just complaining because you're in here. And I said, well, am I under arrest? And she said, no. So she escorted me out. And they were all, you know, jeering and, you know, pointing and making noises and, you know, and I wanted to go confront them. And the policewoman said, no, you can't do that. So I said, all right. So the next morning I filed a complaint with Internal Affairs in Charlotte, and they called me three times on the phone apologizing, because the policewoman then didn't have any right to violate my civil rights. I was not breaking any law. There's actually five parts to the HB 2 law.
Okay.
And the bathroom issue is actually just one. And the other one is minimum wage. Yeah, that's part of HB 2.
Part of HB 2.
And then the other thing was, they stripped all the municipalities of having any rights of passing any ordinances.
So, Janice, is that related to of the state legislature to rescind HB 2 this past week? One of the central issues was the Charlotte exclusion, that Charlotte had created a non-discrimination zone within Charlotte specifically that HB 2 overrode. Is that what you're referring to?
Well, yeah, basically. Greensboro had a non-discrimination policy that wasn't as detailed as Charlotte's. And also Durham was fixing to pass their own version of the Charlotte non-discrimination ordinance right after HB 2 would have been repealed, but it was blocked.
Well, yeah, Jess, this is Jean. And so obviously there was some semblance of an understanding, some semblance of a deal brokered when the special session was called. Can you just generally speak about how that deal unraveled?
Well, what happened was we finally ousted that crazy governor, Pat McCrory.
Yes.
We finally got rid of him.
Good
and
job.
We got a Democrat elected by the name of Roy Cooper. Well, 2 weeks ago, the General Assembly met in special session. I think it was 3 days or so that they were in session, and they stripped our new governor of all his powers.
Yes, I've seen that.
Right. So then because his powers were stripped, they went back and they said, well, we need to repeal HB 2 because it's hurting the state, you know, and it's costing jobs. And so far it's cost over $500 million, you know, to state North Carolina in lost revenue. So the Republicans decided, well, you know, if Charlotte will rescind the ordinance, we will repeal HB 2 and go back to ground zero where we were before. And no ordinance, no HB 2. You know, we just out there like we were 20 years ago. So the Charlotte city mayor and the attorneys, the city council, and also, I don't know how she got invited, but the notorious Tammy Fitzgerald, who was a religious fundamentalist with Forward North Carolina, I believe it is, somehow ended up in that secret meeting that we didn't know anything about. And but anyway, everything started unraveling. It didn't go the way it was supposed to have went. So now we don't have any right. Wow. We don't have a single leg to stand on when we get discriminated against because we're LGBT.
Oh my.
Yeah, I was what do you do next? How do you move forward from here? Like, is there some way to impact the legislation to change the policies? You know, knowing that we've got all of these people that are coming into the next administration that right at the top of their list is to attack, you know, people like us.
So we're going to have a new election in 2017 with these new redrawn districts, and hopefully we'll pick up some seats. Wow. And if we pick up enough seats, then we'll be able to repeal HB 2. The only thing we can do is get people elected in the office that's going to support the LGBT, and it's not just transgender people or non-binary people. It's the entire LGBT is affected with HB 2. But the outside people, like I say, that can pray for us and they give us some support and keep talking it up, because we're like an island, and we're being discriminated against from all sides.
All right. Well, thank you very much for educating us. Does anybody have any closing thoughts?
I do. North Carolina is my home state. I'm just wondering, where's your hometown?
Originally from just outside of Philadelphia, and I came out in San Francisco to Tenderloin, and actually lived in Seattle for a little bit, and then Chicago, and now here.
Well, it's good to hear a little bit of that hometown accent you got going on.
Oh, that's right. We can cook up some chicken flick around here.
Yes, please. Oh, my gosh.
Well, thank you so much for all the work you're doing out there, Janice. Thank you.
Thank you, and y'all have a good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you. All right, we are back, and that was an interview with Janice Covington Ellison about the failure of North Carolina's state legislature to repeal HB 2. So we're back, so let's talk.
Okay.
All right, so do we want to talk about the survey first? Because yeah. I know yeah. I had a few thoughts on that.
Sure, let's do that.
Okay, so to start with, I really like that we have such, as you said, a defensible, concrete piece of evidence now defining what's going on in the transgender community. Because I know I keep hearing so many cisgender people say that trans people are not oppressed. Like, I even once got told recently by someone that, oh, trans people aren't oppressed. You're just oppressing yourselves, however that works. Mm-hmm. But I think that the results of this survey, as shocking as they are, I think it really goes to show that, yes, we are being oppressed in many different ways, and there's a lot of issues that we need to work on here.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers just tell the story of 40% of the people in your community tried to commit suicide, then that would mean that they're oppressed.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Well, you know, I, for one, took... on some of the issues that the numbers showed, I took somewhat the same point of view that Mara shared in the interview. Kind of a sick way of looking at it, I think, is the way she phrased it. But the numbers are bad, but not quite as bad as I would have expected. I think she gave one example where, you know, it's like, yeah, there's kind of a bright side to it, too. So, you know, one of the things that I noticed, and it's really interesting, is that when you look at some of the raw numbers, all the way down at the bottom in the appendices of the report, this was something that was not my understanding about the nature of our community, that 57%, the preponderance of the respondents, were assigned female at birth, folks. And that of that population, about half, it split about 50-50 between FTM and non-binary genderqueer. And then when you looked at the non-binary genderqueer population, the vast preponderance of that population was assigned female at birth. You know, for a long time, the numbers that have been kicked around said that the numbers were more like kind of two-thirds assigned male at birth. And
well,
one-third
I mean,
the other
it's
way,
so. It's important to look. Well, there's a couple of things. Yeah. One is, you know, times are changing. The times they are changing, and it's like
yes, that's clear.
You know, this is definitely the rise of transmasculine culture is like really apparent, and it's a really good because that was the, I mean, for those of us who are trans who go back 25 years, there was a time when like we kind of pretended that like transmasculine, AFAB, you know, gender non-binary, like, didn't exist. We didn't even really recognize that it wasn't part of social media. It wasn't part of our communications, our conversations. But also, it's important to remember that within the survey, as Janice pointed, I mean, as Mara pointed out, within the survey itself, the data collection was really skewed. So it was skewed towards if you were organized, then you responded. And if you were part of a community that wasn't organized, then you didn't respond. So part of the data set is that we need to really do a better job of like getting into the South, you know, getting to people who are not using technology, and also getting to, you know, other non-traditional groups, because right now the groups that are really represented really well in the survey, for instance, were like particularly just from four states, and Mara pointed that out.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's a problem. I mean, it's good that we have this data because it present some picture, but it's not the clearest picture of what our community is.
You know, yeah. And I'd like to see more research projects put into the hands of the community that is being studied. I think that's really crucial for the authenticity and, you know, when you're gathering that type of information. And I think it's also really important just for posterity and for liberation, because when we're gathering data, it's important to remember that we're creating a demographic out of a population of people, and demographics can be used in so many certain ways. And how that information is going to be used and how that demographic is going to be treated is really important. So it's best to have it in the hands of your own, you know?
Yeah, that is true. And like I was talking with Jean about earlier, like I wasn't even too surprised at the high number of AFAB non-binary respondents, because I found in the non-binary community that, you know, the communities that I am active in, like I do notice a lot more AFAB people than AMAB. But on the other hand, most of the people I talk to are either here in Oregon or Washington, where, you know, we probably have a bit of a different demographic, or they're very active online, which there may not be very many active online users in other areas like the South. So I probably have a bit of a different perspective, but you know, that's, I think that's why more research and a better collection of data from other areas, I think, would really help us get a clearer picture.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the other numbers in the survey? Was there anything that really stood out to you from the survey that, like, you didn't realize when you first approached the subject before this month? By the way, also a question, how many of you participated in the survey?
I did.
I think I did. It was back in 2015, but I think I did.
It has been a while ago.
Yeah.
It took a long time.
Yeah, it did. But they did a great job. Yeah. But what about that? Were there any numbers, any information that really stood out to you that you didn't realize before?
Yeah. So something that really shocked me, I mean, there were quite a few things that shocked me, but one of the things that really stood out to me was the amount of discrimination and harassment in schools, especially. I got some numbers here. It was like
54% reported being verbally harassed at school, 24% were physically attacked at school, and 13% were sexually assaulted at school due to their gender identity. And 17% even experienced such severe mistreatment that they left school. Those are really horribly large numbers, and that really goes to show that there's a huge problem in the schools right now for transgender students, and that's something I think needs to be addressed immediately, because there's already so much that youth are going through, especially transgender youth. The last thing they need is to be attacked at school. It just makes things so much worse for them.
Yeah, that's really on the front line of, you know, the cultural wars right now that are going to be happening in the next year or so with the incoming administration.
The new Secretary of Education. Mm-hmm. The new Secretary of Education. What chances do the children and youth of our community stand with somebody with DeVos record? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
It looks like it's going to probably move to the states. So, yeah. I mean, hopefully it won't, but the Supreme Court is about to make this big ruling, which will have a huge impact on this very topic, you know.
Oh, what are they ruling on?
There's a transgendered teenager who is
in Virginia. Virginia.
Yeah, it's been brought all the way. It's about using the bathroom and using public accommodations within the school, and it's made its way all the way to the Supreme Court. So it's one of many cases. Texas is trying to, Texas went kind of crazy and they tried to revoke all of their funds that came directly through this particular ruling, that you only got your federal funds for your school district if you actually recognized and acknowledged and provided accommodations for trans students at high schools and at, grade schools in Texas. And several school districts were willing to just completely withdraw federal funding. And, just completely impoverished, their entire school districts, just so that trans kids couldn't use the bathroom.
Wow. Cases just regarding Gavin Grimm is the name of the person in question. Yeah.
We touched on this in the interview as well. We did there was a whole section in the interview where we pointed out that, the numbers that Nicolette is citing here, these aren't, they're not even reflecting the current situation in schools. And my speculation is that with more trans folks out, more trans children out in schools, those numbers have to be,
They're probably much higher.
Much higher,
because
I would think.
They only had participants over 18 years old. So what's going on in participants under 18?
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's actually our biggest growing demographic right now.
It is.
Yeah.
Nationally for those of us who are on the trans spectrum. Mm-hmm. So
there was another set of numbers that I did observe, and it's this is my own extrapolation from Appendix A. I mean, I dove way down in the weeds in some of the raw numbers, but it takes a little bit of chain of logic here, but in general it appears that AFAB folks are generally better off financially than AMAB, and it's interesting to look at that. They tended to be more likely to be in multi-income households.
AFAB transgender folks, they've transitioned. Yeah.
Yes, exactly, and. Tended to have a more stable employment situation. That's interesting to me. And what I'm getting from that is that at some point in transition, they began to enjoy the benefits of the patriarchy, I think. This is not an allegation or anything. It's just reality.
It's just coming back to the fact that misogyny is the root of all this oppression.
Yes.
Yeah, totally.
Well, and also how easy it is to access, different gender identities and what a ridiculous system of privilege that is,
Exactly.
So
thank you, intersex representative. For bringing us to reality.
It's a system of identification which one can access evidently, and as soon as you masculinize yourself, you evidently, if this data might point to, if you are able to and go through with accessing masculinity within this culture that might be profitable for you. And that's a system of privilege that you can cosmetically arrange for yourself if you'd like to, you know?
That is so true.
And that's gender identity. And who knows, you know, who knows about self-expression or anything like that. But for me, gender identity and self-expression, I think, I don't know, I'm going to stop there.
Let's talk for just a couple of minutes about the Portland Trans Town Hall. Could we do that for a couple of minutes? Before we run out of time?
Yeah, I was going to say, I wanted to touch on my thing real quick, but you can go ahead if you want.
Let's go ahead
and do this real fast, and then we'll get to that other item, okay?
Okay.
All right.
Sorry.
This is just a reminder for everybody, kind of a make a plug here for an upcoming event. There is a trans community town hall that is happening this coming Friday, January 6th, from 5:30 p.m., to 8:30 p.m. at the Q Center at 4115 North Mississippi Ave here in Portland. The nature of this is kind of three, it's going to be in three parts. There'll be some guest speakers. There's going to be presentations by several organizations which serve the trans and queer community in Portland. We know that Equi Institute will be represented. OHSU's Trans Health Program will be represented. Cascades AIDS Project will be represented, and several others. And then there will also be a moderated open discussion as part of the interaction with all of those. So. And allies are welcome and encouraged to attend. The folks that are putting this on are hoping that this is going to be the first of a series. And, you know, so everybody in the trans community is welcome and encouraged to show up.
So that's the Portland Trans Town Hall, Friday, January 6th, 5:30 p.m. At the Q Center. Hope you can make it.
All right. So something I was hoping to talk about today before we run out of time is I recently read the latest National Geographic issue with the cover story Gender Revolution.
Yes.
I haven't read the whole thing yet, but I did read the cover story article at least, and I wanted to give my thoughts on it. So I did really like that it explains terms like transgender, intersex, and non-binary in ways that someone who's unfamiliar with these terms can hopefully understand. And I like that it covers a fairly wide spectrum of gender variance and doesn't focus on just binary trans people, because there's still a lot of people that don't even know that non-binary and intersex do actually exist.
Can I just interrupt really quickly? I do want to make just a quick note for posterity in that National Geographic printed edition.
Yeah, go ahead.
The definition for intersex is actually printed incorrectly. So for a more accurate definition on intersex, you can look to their online edition of this article or go to the UN World Health Organization website.
Yeah, that was one of the things I wanted to note. There were some other things in the article that weren't quite so great. Like, you know, there were some definitions that they gave that, you know, I thought were just kind of oversimplified and weren't fully accurate. I wasn't even sure if some of their statistics were fully accurate. Like, they claimed that, you know, over 99% of people identify as a binary gender. But looking at, you know, the results from the trans survey, it might actually be a much higher number than that. So, you know, maybe with more studies, we'll know what that actual number is. But I think it's higher than that, the percentage of non-binary people. Let's see. Another thing that I'm concerned about is at one point they made a connection between non-binary genders and autism based on a study that was done. And I mean, I can kind of see why they would include that, but at the same time, it's like it didn't need to be included, and I'm worried about the implications that mentioning that in this article could have on those communities, because those are two communities that are already facing so much oppression and discrimination, and it's terrible that already I've been seeing so many comments from internet trolls saying, oh, if you think you're non-binary, you're really just autistic, and, you know, all sorts of disgusting things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really worried about, you know, what kind of repercussions that could cause. Mm-hmm. And one last thing, the conclusion, I think, seemed a little confusing to me. It almost seemed like the author was implying that Fafa Fine, the third gender in Samoan culture, are really just gay men. I mean, they may have not meant it that way, but it seemed a little confusing to me. So,
okay.
Yeah, those are just my notes on it.
Well, thank you so much. So we've just got about a minute left in our show. I do want to give a plug out for our show next month is going to be
trans, gender non-binary, gender non-conforming, intersex, love and sex. So it's going to be our love and sex show. We're going to be talking about orgasms. We're going to be talking about body parts. We're going to be talking about how trans people get off. So I hope you will join us next month on Trans Positive for our Valentine's show.
You're not going to want to miss it.
Thank you. I'm Emma.
I'm Jean.
I'm Carrie.
And I'm Nicolette.
Thanks for joining us. Good night.
Good night. Bye. Thank you. Rebel, rebel, how could they know?
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the opening reception for Giving Back, the Soul of Philanthropy, reframed and exhibited Tuesday, January 13th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library in Portland. The reception is an opportunity to tour the exhibit, which illustrates the Black philanthropic experience, hear from exhibit creators, and connect with social justice movement leaders from across Portland. Again, that's the opening reception for Giving Back, the Soul of Philanthropy, reframed and exhibited Tuesday, January 13th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library, 2811 Northeast Holman Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Dookie Jam, taking place monthly on the first Thursdays at Dante's in Portland. Dookie Jam is an open funk jam session for musicians, vocalists, MCs, and everyone who is over 21. Again, that's Dookie Jam this month on Thursday, January 5th at Dante's, 350 West Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.